Welcome to Shattering Myths. This is the program where we expose the misconceptions that are associated with politics and with religion, with economic schemes as well as military schemes. Instead of merely presenting the news this morning, I'm going to try to explain the motivations behind the perpetrators and also explain what these events portend for our future. Then, during our second hour, we're going to engage God on His terms, by way of His one and only covenant, and through His Torah, which means teaching. Our goal will be to replace religion with reason. Our phone number, if you would like to question, criticize, or affirm anything that is said during the next 2 hours, is 877-300-7645. And for those seeking a verification of the positions articulated during the Shattering Myths show, you're encouraged to go to introtogod.org, yadaya.com, prophetofdoom.net, or questioningpaul.com. Yesterday, we discussed the pagan associations between Halloween and Christianity. It was interesting that we could get into that subject by way of an article that was posted by the BBC relative to the Polish Catholic Church condemning Halloween, saying that Halloween was pagan and that it was occultist and that it was improper. And that was funny because it is the Roman Catholic Church that legitimized the pagan practice of Halloween. And we went all through its history as well as the multiple decrees by popes legitimizing and Christianizing the pagan practice that has long been celebrated as Halloween. So now that we've done that, let's turn our attention to the next Christian holiday, to Christmas. It is based upon the Dies Natalis Solis Invicti, which is the birthday of the unconquerable Son. Now, the unconquerable Son is not S-O-N, but S-U-N. It is the day that the Roman legions honored Mithras, the Babylonian sun god, the god of Constantine, who was the founder of Roman Catholicism. During the reign of Aurelian in the 3rd century CE, the December 25th observance of the birthday of the unconquerable Sun was promoted as an empire-wide holiday. Back in the time of Julius Caesar, the Saturnalia, named after the Roman god Saturn, was observed on the winter solstice, which also fell on December 25th. It marked the birth of the Son of the Sun. This date was chosen because 9 months earlier, the Mother of God and the Queen of Heaven, the Madonna and Mother Earth, the scriptural Astarte, and the Babylonian Semiramis, who became Ishtar, was impregnated by the sun on Easter, marked by the Sunday nearest the spring equinox. This pagan religious holiday featured a bunny who laid colorful eggs, the consumption of ham, and hot cross buns, not unlike the celebration of Easter today. Also similar to the observance of Christmas, the Saturnalia, termed Dies Natalis Solis Invicti, was celebrated by exchanging gifts, placing lights on trees cut from the woods, and hanging circular wreaths, as well as burning Yule logs. All are vestiges of these pagan celebrations. These customs, still practiced by the preponderance of Christians today, aren't popular with God. This is what he had to say. Hear the word which Yahweh proclaims to you, old household of Yisrael, which means individuals who engage and endure with God. Yahweh says, do not walk in the ways of the Goyim nations, of the people from different races and places, the heathens and pagans. And do not teach, Lamad, do not become accustomed to the signs and symbols from the sky. For the Gentiles, these people from different nations and places, are confused and destroyed by them. For the customs and traditions of foreign nations are delusional. the cultural communities estrange one from me. They cut down trees from the forest, the work of their hands with an axe. Then they decorate it with silver and gold. They fasten it down so it will not topple over. Their trees are like finely decorated cultic objects. They can't speak. They can't walk. They must be carried. Don't revere them. Indeed, from them there is nothing beneficial. There is none like you, Yahweh. You are powerful, and your great personal and proper name is mighty. Who would not revere you? Indeed, it is your due. For in all of the wise men and Gentile nations, and in all of their empires, there is none like you. They are all together unreceptive. Barbarians, senseless, destructive, indeed stupid. And they are foolish, completely lacking in understanding in their doctrines and teachings related to delusional items made like decorated trees. You see, God's not real fond of the Christmas tree. If you have a Christmas tree and that is part of your celebration of Christmas and you think that Christmas has something to do with God, you would be mistaken. In his letter to Goyim, to people from different races and places, he specifically told us not to participate in these things. Now, Cyprian, who is considered a church father, and he is also a wealthy pagan whose writings transformed him into a venerated Catholic saint, he wrote, "Oh, how wonderfully acted Providence." You know, Providence is the god of Mein Kampf, of Hitler's Rant. "Oh, how wonderfully acted Providence that on that day on which the sun was born," the S-U-N, capitalized by the way, S-U-N was born, "Christ should also be born." It is from this kind of irrational and ignorant reasoning that religions are born. And that is why the Catholic Eucharist asserts that Sol Invicticus, the festival of Sol Invicticus, has a strong claim on the responsibility for the date of Christmas. Yes, you can turn to the Catholic Encyclopedia, and they acknowledge that the pagan Roman celebration of Sol Invicticus has a strong claim on the responsibility for the date of Christmas. There is nothing even remotely akin to Christmas spoken of in Scripture. It is not a holiday celebrated by God or one of the 7 days that God encourages us to meet with Him. Nor is there anything remotely akin to Easter. Mario Righetti, a renowned Catholic literist, wrote, quote, "The Church of Rome, to facilitate the acceptance of the faith by pagan masses, found it convenient to institute the 25th of December as the feast for the temporal birth of Christ, to divert them from the pagan feast, celebrated on the same day, in honor of the invincible son, Mithras." End quote. And through this corruption turned counterfeit, the meaning and the purpose of tabernacles, of sukkah, was lost. More important still, the masses were taught to celebrate the birth of Jesus, an irrational impossibility if he were God. Well, I cannot predict your reaction to this horrible news. I can tell you that the more I learn, the more I come to dislike the church for what this whore has done. It isn't an accident that Yahweh's seven essential days, his called out assemblies, which embody the way to him, were concealed, corrupted, and counterfeited by man's religious institutions, particularly Roman Catholicism. It isn't an accident that the church's replacements for each of Yahweh's seven invitations to be called out and meet with him were counterfeited by pagan holidays, all based upon the worship of the sun, S-U-N. All derived from Babylon, from Egypt, from Greece, and indeed Rome. One such error would have been a horrible coincidence. Scores of them is something entirely different. Moving on to the news, we learned a couple of days ago that an Iranian naval task force, which probably consists of three rowboats and a canoe, docked in the Sudan, carrying with it a, quote, message of peace and security to neighboring countries, end quote. The Iranian state media reported. You know, nothing says peace like ships carrying destructive weapons. Their arrival came 6 days after explosions destroyed an arms factory in the Sudanese capital of Khartoum. Now, just to put this in perspective, I know there's a lot of horrible Islamic countries out there, but the poster child for horror and terrible and genocidal isn't actually worn by either Pakistan or by Syria or even by Iran. There is a worse Islamic country out there, worse than Saudi Arabia, worse than Egypt, worse than Yemen. Yes, indeed. The most genocidal, the most vicious Islamic country on earth isn't even Somalia. It's the Sudan. That's where the Iranians have built their weapons manufacturing plant to make rockets to kill Israelis. But those rockets and weapons don't just kill Israelis, they also have been used to murder over 3 million Sudanese Africans who are animists, Christians, or African Muslims. The most genocidal nation on earth today is the Sudan, the very place where the Iranians decided to build their weapons factory. All you need to know about their character and their choices. Hello and welcome back to Shattering Myths. We were talking about how Iran has chosen to locate a military armament factory in what is the most despicable nation on earth today. It is the Sudan, an entirely Islamic, fundamentalist Islamic regime that has perpetrated the genocide on its people. Over the past 25 years, the Islamic government, which is controlled by Arab Muslims in Sudan, has murdered over 3 million African animists, African Christians, and African Muslims. When we speak of Darfur, which is the region of the Sudan where Arab Muslims are killing African Muslims, that is in the Sudan. That is where Iran thought would be a charming place for them to build a weapons factory. Well, there is a rumor that, and Sudan has complained to the United Nations, that Israel has bombed the factory. Well, it's a factory which is not only operated by Iran, but it is the primary source from which Iranian missiles are made and sent to Hamas so that they can fire them into Israeli civilian areas. The factory is operated by Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps, and its primary purpose is to produce weapons for the Palestinian Islamists, particularly Hamas. So I can't tell you whether or not the Israelis bombed the factory, but if they did, great. Reuters has reported that a suicide bomber drove a vehicle packed with explosives. Now, suicide bomber, what religion do you think he is? In fact, just the fact that that suicide bomber and religion are not mutually exclusive but coterminous concepts is stunning in a way, isn't it? You know, the kamikazes of World War II, they were the most religiously devoted Japanese boys. The SS, who comprised much of the most horrible deeds perpetrated by the Nazis, were the most religious Nazis. Well, suicide bombing is the exclusive domain today, and has been for better part of two decades now, of Muslims. The most fundamentalist Muslims encourage it. The most fundamentalist Muslims make it possible through the manufacture of the bombs and the recruiting of the bombers. And it is devout Muslim boys and girls who then turn themselves into bombs. So a suicide bomber, Muslim, drove a vehicle packed with explosives into a Catholic church in northern Nigeria on Sunday, killing at least five people and wounding and mutilating over 100 more. It, of course, triggered reprisals that killed at least two more individuals. There was no immediate claim of responsibility, but the Islamic sect Boko Haram, which means that books are forbidden, has claimed similar attacks in the past and has attacked several churches with bombs and guns since it intensified its campaign against Christians over these past few years. Church attacks often target Nigeria's middle belt, where its largely Christian south and mostly Muslim north meet, and where sectarian tensions therefore run high. Kaduna's mixed population lies along that fault line. Shortly after the blast, angry Christians, also being religious, took to the streets armed with sticks and knives. A Reuters reporter saw two bodies on the roadside lying in pools of blood. Quote, "We killed them and we'll kill more," shouted a youth with blood on his shirt before police chased him and his cohorts away. You know, this notion that you justify killing with killing is morally bankrupt. You know, Yah's instruction is do not make a habit of, do not make a practice of killing. When you kill as a response to killing, that's what you're doing. It is Muslims who have made a practice of killing through their religiously inspired suicide bombings, and it very often is now Christians and Buddhists, depending on which country you're living in, who are responding to these Muslim atrocities by making a practice of killing. Now, even beyond the fact that killing is not the moral answer to killing, there is also this issue that the Christians in this case lashed out and killed Muslims who were not responsible for the bombing. And that's even more reprehensible. We're going to return to this story and consider this universal response of religious individuals to kill, to avenge killing. After the break, I am Yada. This is Shattering Myths. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. Scott and I were talking during the break, as we often do. And on this particular break, we were talking about how parents are so proud of their children when their children become suicide bombers in the Islamic world. There are actually, through the so-called Palestinian territories, there are trading cards, just like we have baseball cards, you know, the kids collect. Well, in the Islamic world, they don't play baseball. They have trading cards of suicide bombers. There's cards of the parents of suicide bombers who are so proud of their sons and daughters for having blown themselves to smithereens, killing innocent women and children. But the highly collectible cards, of course, are the cards of the suicide bombers themselves. They become heroes. In fact, we were talking about, Israel blew up an Islamic bomb-making factory, but the primary bomb-making factories of the Muslim world are their women's wombs. Now, shortly before and after the blast, we heard that Christians, youths, took to the street, and that they decided that they would go off and kill a couple of Muslims. This is kind of like America's response in World War II, where the Japanese flew planes over Pearl Harbor, caught us napping, and killed 3,000 Americans. So in response, we thought we would avenge the deaths of 3,000 Americans by killing millions of Japanese, mostly women and children, by the way, by firebombing their cities, and then sacrificing another 350,000 American lives in pursuit of this avenge. I don't understand how that can be considered moral, good. How is that winning? Well, anyway, in Nigeria, which was once the most prosperous and freest country in Africa, at least 2,800 people have been killed in the fighting as a direct result of Boko Haram's, which they say here, insurrection. Boko Haram is not an insurrection. They are not insurgents. Boko Haram are fundamentalist Muslims. They're coming out of the almost exclusively Muslim north now of Nigeria. They are not trying to do anything other than impose Islamic Sharia law. Now, Sharia law is already imposed on the north. They're trying to impose Sharia law on the remainder of the country. They aren't interested in insurrection. They are interested in the spread of fundamentalist Islam. Most of the killings have been perpetrated by Muslims, and they typically target Christians. The sect says it is fighting to create an Islamic state in the whole of Nigeria, whose 160 million people are split roughly evenly between Christians and Muslims. The country used to be almost exclusively Christian. We were talking in the break as to why the Christianity and Christians, for the most part, apart from some people in the Roman Catholic countries, where birth control is prohibited by the Pope for reasons of power and control. But nonetheless, how apart from just a few pockets, the Islamic world is about all that is increasing in population, and the rest of the world, particularly the Christian world, is decreasing in population. The birth rate is not able to sustain the existing population. So we're in the midst of experiencing what Nigeria is experiencing, where a very small minority of Muslims have become actually a majority of that country at this time. Moving on to another less violent, but another side of Islam. In Istanbul, their most famous pianist was charged with inciting hatred and insulting the values of Muslims. He was prosecuted over tweets he wrote mocking radical, this says, Muslims. No, he was mocking fundamentalist Muslims. In a case which has rekindled concern over the religious influence in Turkey. As a matter of fact, we won't complete all of them on today's program, but I have three or four articles on Turkey, because Turkey is kind of the place we ought to keep our eye as we look towards the growing influence of fundamentalist Islam and what that will ultimately lead to in terms of a war between Muslims and Israel, ultimately bringing the entire world into that war. Prosecutors brought charges against Mr. Say, who is this pianist, in June. He faces a 18-month prison sentence. The indictment against him cites some of his tweets from April of this year, including one where he says, "I'm not sure if you have also realized it, but if there's a louse, if there's a lowlife, if there's a thief or a fool, it's almost always an Islamist." What he said seems to ring true, but you can't tell the truth in Turkey anymore. This also is from Istanbul, Turkey. At a reception on Monday evening at the president's mansion to celebrate Turkey's founding 89 years ago, something previously unheard of occurred. The country's top military commander stood alongside the wives of the president and prime minister, even while the women wore Islamic headscarves. Now, why would you say that is a big deal? Well, in years past, the military's elite would never have stood beside a woman, much less a woman wearing the symbol long at the center of Turkey's struggle over the role of religion in public life. These men, the military, were heirs to the traditions of Turkey's secular founder, Kemal Atatürk, who zealously banished religion from public life. They had for years refused to attend any such gathering in protest of the headscarf, the source of Islamic dominion over the rights of women. For many Turks, the reception underscored the break from the past when civilian leaders were subservient to the military and Islam was filtered from public life. But that is no more. Turkey's melding of democratic and Islamic values, if you can say Islamic has values, are being put forward as a model for the Arab world. And yet, the country is facing its own turmoil over internal power struggles between Islamists and secularists. But I'm here to tell you, all of the secularists are being imprisoned. They're being killed. It's only Islam that is being allowed to remain. Just in this year, 300 generals who were proponents of secularism in Turkey were imprisoned or killed at orders of the prime minister. Civilian leaders and military commanders are recognizing that to survive in today's Turkey, you have to be a fundamentalist Muslim. This article says the outcome could not only determine the future of Turkey, the outcome is ordained, it is certain, as it takes on a greater role in the affairs of the Middle East, but also as it attempts to shape the region. You see, Turkey is in a unique position. Turkey is not an Arab country, and Islam is almost universally associated with Arabs. Now, the fact is the most populous Islamic country is Malaysia, which isn't Arab at all. The fact is, most Muslims aren't Arab. But yet, Arab and Islam have become coterminous in terms of presentation of ideas because Muslims want those who speak against Islam to be considered bigots and racists. So they identify themselves as Arabs as opposed to Muslims, because to be opposed to a religion is not bigoted, it's not racist. To be opposed to a race is, of course, bigoted. Now, in the case of Turkey, the Turks are not Arabs. As a matter of fact, the Ottoman Empire was a result of the Mongolians under, you know, initially the Mongol hordes were led by Genghis Khan and then his son Kublai Khan and then ultimately Tamerlane, the most ruthless of the Mongols, accepted Islam because he recognized that Islam made his raiders far more barbarian, far more ruthless, and therefore they enriched him and he could control them in this way. And as a result, the Mongols ultimately conquered Turkey. And when they did, they were so much stronger than the residue of what had really been the Byzantine Christians. They were so much stronger than the Byzantines that had been there, so much more vicious, that they created the Ottoman Empire. And the Ottoman Empire didn't like Arab Muslims. And so they not only conquered all of these Arab lands, they oppressed the Arabs, even oppressed Muslims, even though they had embraced Islam for the purpose of looting the world. And so today, when an Arab country like Egypt, which used to be Copt Christian, by the way, but now is 90% Arab Muslim, and other countries throughout the Arab world, like Saudi Arabia and Syria, they would look at Turkey as an oppressor because of the issues with the Ottoman Empire. And that's the reason why the Brits were able to get Arab Muslims to fight along with them against the Ottoman Empire. That's the whole story of Lawrence of Arabia. And they promised these Arab Muslims their own private fiefdoms if they prevailed in defeating the Ottoman Empire, which is how the Middle East as we know it today was formed at about this same time. And it's at this same time that modern Turkey was born out of the defeat of the Ottoman Empire. And it was born secular. It was born as a military dictatorship. But that's not what it is anymore. Today, it has become a fundamentalist Islamic region, but it's Turkey that's trying to assert its influence now on Arab Muslims. Now, this article goes on to say, while many praise the diminished power of the military, critics say that these struggles have also laid bare the deficiencies of Turkey's democracy, pointing in particular to the Islamist-leaning government's crackdown on any dissent. Any dissent, they're talking about anything that isn't fundamentalist Islamic, is imprisoned, is censured. There is no allowance to speak honestly and openly about the role of secularism in the life of Turkey, only of Islam in the life of Turks. And we're going to return to this story because it's going to have a tremendous influence on the world as we move towards the Magog War and the Tribulation. I am Yada. This is Shattering Myths. Hello and welcome back to Shattering Myths. One of the things that you need to know when you consider Turkey and the fact that Turkey has become an Islamist country as opposed to a country where people can choose whether they wish to be secular or sectarian, is that there are more journalists in jail in Turkey than anywhere else on earth. Now, that has given rise to a chorus of frustration, and that was on display this week as Turkey celebrated its birthday. In Ankara, the capital, thousands of secular protesters clashed with riot police and as they tried to celebrate Republic Day. But Turkey's Islamist government, with Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan at its helm, lashed out at them, sent the army after them because he does not want to even tolerate any secular celebration. The symbolism, as well as the Republic Day rallies in Ankara and Istanbul to protest what many secularists view as increasing authoritarianism, which is a natural result of Islam. In Islam, there is no democracy. There is only dictatorship. Underscored Turkey's deep divides that threaten to see the end of all secularism. Mr. Erdogan's Justice and Development Party has its roots in political Islam and therefore has close connections with Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood. Turkey, this article concludes, seems increasingly caught between its secular past and an unknown future. Oh, that future is knowable. It is obvious. The future is the present. Turkey has become an Islamist country. It is, in all but word, a dictatorship. There is no dissent. It's kind of like Russia. You know, we consider Russia a democracy now because they vote. Well, the new dictator of Russia, Putin, has seen to it that he controls all of the media and he controls all of the candidates. If you try to run against him, you are imprisoned. If you try to report something opposed to him, he not only gets you fired, but he gets you imprisoned because he owns all of the media outlets. Turkey, the same thing is true, but Turkey has turned to a different form of fascism. That's Islamic fascism. This next story is also Dateline Istanbul. With a war on Turkey's borders and economic troubles in Egypt, the two countries have turned to each other for support, looking to build an alliance that could represent a significant geopolitical shift in the Middle East, prompted and promoted by the so-called Arab Spring, which is an Islamic reformation. Uniting the two countries with regional ambitions, each headed by parties with roots in political Islam. Yes, both the Erdogan's party and the Muslim Brotherhood share exactly the same Islamic values. Turkey has offered a host of measures to bolster Egypt's economy, trying to endear what was an enemy of Egypt as a newfound friend. And that is a $2 billion package. There's also a wider partnership to be announced this week when the Turkish Prime Minister, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, visits. And this article also reinforces his political party shares an Islamist pedigree in sync with Egypt's leadership, which was born out of the Muslim Brotherhood. The emerging alliance springs from the earthquake that shook the regional order when Egypt's president, Hosni Mubarak, was ousted from the, during the, and also from, it says, the civil war in Syria. So, see, the only link, really, that Turkey had to the Islamic Arab world was via Syria. Syria was a client of Iraq, and Iraq were mostly Persians, and the Persians in Iraq were part of a secular Ba'athist party, and the Ba'athist party in Syria had an alliance. That alliance was destroyed when America invaded Iraq, giving Iraq to Iran. It then continued to deteriorate as Iran now came to control Syria. And so Turkey and Syria, which were once allies, are now enemies, all as a direct result of American malfeasance. And now because Turkey has become fundamentalist Islam, as has Egypt, they now have a new alliance.